want our children to have the best chance to live fulfilling lives. But can you keep up with all the books and scientific research on parenting and fit the information into your own philosophy on how to raise kids? Welcome to Your Parenting Mojo, the podcast that does the work for you by investigating and examining respectful, research-based parenting tools to help kids thrive. Now, welcome your host, Jen Lumenlon.
And welcome to today's episode of Your Parenting Mojo podcast, and we have lots to talk about today. The official title for our episode today is On Education and on Betsy DeVos. And I actually had the idea to do this episode a few weeks back, but I sort of sat on it for a bit, in part because it's such a complex issue. Not that I'm any stranger to researching and writing and talking about complex issues, but because this one's still in motion and nobody really knows yet how it's going to turn out. So today we're going to talk a little bit about the education system here in the US and how it got to be where it is at the moment, and also what Betsy DeVos might do with it. And the point that I want to make with this episode is, what if the focus on which kind of school is the right kind is the wrong question to ask? And not entirely coincidentally, I also want to let you know that I'm launching a course to help parents who are thinking about homeschooling their children to decide whether homeschooling could actually be the right thing for their families. The course will cover all the aspects of making that decision, from understanding whether homeschooling is legal in your area to how you'll still be able to afford your mortgage, from whether you need to understand everything your child needs to know before you even begin, to whether homeschooled children can get into college. You'll hear from more than 20 families who are already homeschooling, as well as from 7 experts on different aspects of homeschooling, from choosing a curriculum to homeschooling without a curriculum at all. And I should note that while today's episode is focused on the education system in the US, the course is much more broadly applicable, no matter where you live. Right now, I'm looking for a few people who are interested in homeschooling to help me pilot test the course. So you would take the course and let me know what you think of it through email feedback or a phone conversation with me. And in exchange for your opinions, I'm offering a steep discount. The cost for the pilot will be $99, which will be a 50% discount on the full price of the course. If you'd like more details with no obligation at all to sign up, please do send me an email at jen@yourparentingmojo.com. I should probably also mention that I graduated from my master's program. For those of you who have been following along since the beginning, I launched this podcast as a way to share some of the information I was learning as I worked towards a master's in psychology focused on child development. So I'm all done with school, again, for now, at least, although I should note that I reserve the right to go back and get a third master's in education in the not-too-distant future if I decide that it's warranted. But anyway, here's my celebration for the one just finished. Yay! That's more celebrating than I've done for any of my previous degrees, so I hope you enjoyed being part of it. So moving swiftly on, I actually wrote my thesis on the topic of what motivates unschooled children to learn. Unschooling is a specific kind of homeschooling where the parent doesn't directly teach the child anything unless the child specifically requests it. Instead, the child is permitted to engage in self-directed learning, which means the child decides what he or she wants to learn and the parent supports the child in that effort. Now, before you say, that sounds like a crazy idea, let me tell you about some of the research on schools that I delved into as a foundation for my work, which I felt was needed before I started trying to understand an alternate model. I'd always kind of assumed that the purpose of school is to help students develop to their full potential, and maybe to help even out some of the disparities and circumstances that separate people at birth. I was actually really surprised to find out that that wasn't the case at all. We live in a capitalist economy, and schools produce the workers for that capitalist economy. It's the school's job to turn out the workers capable of participating in that economy so they can produce goods for people to buy and so the employers can keep making profit. And to do this, the school system uses grades and test results to determine individuals' position in the system that they will find themselves in once they graduate. An Austrian philosopher called Ivan Illich pointed out that the pupil is thereby schooled to confuse teaching with learning, grade advancement with education, a diploma with competence, and fluency with the ability to say something new. His imagination is schooled to accept service in place of value, end quote. If you think about it, there's actually a close correspondence between the hierarchical nature of a workplace and the hierarchical nature of a school. A student has about as much power in a school as a worker does in the workplace. The extrinsic motivators of grades and approval from teachers, as well as the threat of failure, closely mirror the external motivators in the workplace. Positive performance reviews and increased wages, as well as the prospect of unemployment. The highly rule-governed world of high school mirrors the kind of supervision that a blue-collar worker can expect to receive. The freedom from continual supervision in elite colleges mirrors the work environment of white-collar workers, while moderate amount of freedom granted to students in state colleges and community colleges reflects the amount of supervision people in low-level technical or supervisory roles can expect in the working world. When I first started reading all that, I kind of found it a bit depressing. As a product of the school system myself, who didn't learn to think critically at all until about age 18, and that was something I stumbled on when I realized my psychology teacher was telling us about one theory one day, and then another the next day, presenting each one as a fact, and I said, wait, didn't the guy from yesterday say the opposite? I did well in what would generally consider to be called elite schools, so I have the luxury of doing the majority of my work while sitting on my couch at home, because I've quote-unquote earned this right. Yet I am to some extent trapped in this role by a hefty mortgage in a high cost of living area and the trappings of middle class life. I want to be clear that I don't think anyone is conspiring against us. I think the majority of teachers go into teaching because they want to help children. And the majority of people working in companies that contribute to things like the Common Core standards, because a lot of companies do have a lot at stake in developing the Common Core standards, don't have nefarious interests. They're just doing what they're supposed to do, which is to make money for their company, and the individuals involved probably think they're doing something to help children as well. But these individuals are working within that system that is all about creating workers for the economy, and really isn't at all about helping individuals to achieve their own personal goals. And the school system is really great at one thing, which is preparing children for the kinds of jobs that existed in the US between about 1880 and 1960. At the height of the manufacturing era when factories needed people to sit in a row and churn out widgets that looked exactly like the widgets their neighbor was making. But in a world where employers look for leadership and the ability to work in a team and communication skills and problem-solving skills and a strong work ethic, the memorization of facts starts to look markedly less important. Even now, the system is not designed to help children achieve their learning goals. I read a great article in The Atlantic describing how the school system doesn't want to change because it serves the needs of its adult stakeholders quite well, both politically and financially. Politicians find schools useful for providing placement opportunities for important constituents and the means to get favored community and business programs adopted and funded, and patronage hires for individuals who perform some kind of favor for the politician. Politicians get support from teachers' unions, who are among the top spenders in politics, and who can get a person elected or stop a person that they see as being unfavorable to the union from being elected. The unions want more money and power, which means getting more members. And to get more members, they need happy members. And to get happy members, they need to help members get what they want, which includes job security and pay related to seniority rather than performance, and less work and early retirement with pension and healthcare. So as Jill Klein wrote in The Atlantic, whether you work hard or don't, get good results with kids or don't, teach in a shortage area like math or special education or don't, or in a hard-to-staff school in a poor community or not, you get paid the same, unless you've been around for another year, in which case you get more. Not bad for the adults. Klein thinks that three things are necessary to make schools successful: rebuild the entire K-12 system on a platform of accountability, attract more top-flight recruits into teaching, and use technology very differently to improve instruction. I have no objections at all to attracting and hiring better teachers, and I think there is the potential to use technology to improve instruction, although Klein admits that he is now paid by the News Corporation to work exactly on this, so it would be more surprising if this topic didn't make it into his top three. My main objection, actually, to his proposal is to rebuild the K-12 system on a platform of accountability, by which he means getting children to take standardized tests and tying teacher pay to children's performance on those tests. Now, in my pre-master's days, before I started researching this topic, I would see news articles on the Obama administration's Race to the Top initiative, and I would think that tying teacher pay to student performance sounded like a pretty good idea. Why wouldn't you pay teachers more when their students get better test scores? And then when I started to learn more about this, I realized how some teachers were achieving better test scores. They were sacrificing real deep learning on subjects the students were interested in favor of simple fact memorization to improve the test scores. Finland has taken the exact opposite approach, professionalizing teaching, requiring a master's degree for entry into the system, paying new recruits more, unlike the system in the US, which pays new teachers horrifically badly and backloads the compensation into the early retirement and pension with health benefits for those teachers who hang on for 25 years, even though they're burned out and just going through the motions, and giving teachers a great deal of freedom to determine what they teach and how they teach it. Finland's children are only tested once at the end of high school, but when they're tested, they far outscore American children. For several years, Finland was at the very top of international league tables of student performance, although those numbers have dropped a bit in recent years as they go through a period of budgetary pressure. And the more I learned about standardized testing, the more I realized that standardized testing isn't really a very good way to assess what children know. Firstly, it's possible the tests used to assess children's performance may be biased against poor, non-white children, because they tend to require a specific set of skills and knowledge that's more likely to be possessed by children of higher socioeconomic backgrounds. Secondly, the socioeconomic gap is widened because children from rich families get test preparation outside of school, which children from poor families can't afford. Thirdly, standardized tests tend to measure, as much as anything else, a child's ability to take a standardized test, which is usually a different skill set from that needed to engage in deep learning and critical inquiry. In fact, researchers at the RAND Corporation looked at standardized tests from 17 states and picked the states whose tests are regarded as the most demanding. 0% of students were assessed on deeper learning in mathematics. Somewhere between 1 and 6% were assessed on deeper learning in reading, and 2 to 3% were assessed on deeper learning in writing through those tests. Fourthly, many educators are leaving the field because they're frustrated by the difficulty of trying to produce high-quality teaching in a political environment that prizes test results above all else. Fifthly, it's especially the teachers of struggling children who are affected, as these children are branded failures along with their teachers when required test outcomes aren't met. So who are the main beneficiaries of increased reliance on testing? Well, the companies that produce the tests, for one. Standard & Poor's, the financial rating service, has been contracted by the state of Michigan and also the state of Pennsylvania to the tune of $10 million each to publish the performance of every school district in each state, based largely on test score results, and on the assumption that test score results are an appropriate metric of school performance. But Standard & Poor's has a vested interest in this conclusion. It's owned by McGraw-Hill, which is one of the largest creators of standardized tests. And luckily, McGraw-Hill also offers products that teachers can use to raise student test scores for an additional fee. The magazine Business Week published a cover story in 2001 to make the case that test-based accountability is the way of the future. And by coincidence, McGraw-Hill also owns Business Week. A woman named Charlotte Frank joined the state of New York's top education policymaking panel in 2000, a side job, we assume, to her role as vice president at McGraw-Hill. So, now we have a new Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, who wants to shake up the system for the benefit of children. Although DeVos has said that she doesn't see much of a role for the Department of Education, which Republicans have introduced a bill to abolish at the end of 2018 anyway, since all the anti-discrimination issues which she thought the federal government could have a role to play in have been sorted out by now. Although apparently DeVos hasn't read the news reports saying that discrimination is on the rise. DeVos certainly isn't the first to think the Department of Education is superfluous. I was actually surprised to learn that it's only been around since 1979, and both President Ronald Reagan, as well as the majority of the 2016 Republican presidential candidates, have called for it to be abolished. All of this would leave the role of the education to the states, which sounds great. They are, after all, closer to the people consuming that education. Until you realize that even with federal oversight, states tend to report an exceptionally rosy picture of school achievement, while reporting a rather less rosy picture to national administrators, which can produce reports to let parents know about this gap. And that students with special needs, whether those be educational needs or simply being from a low-income or minority family, don't get an equivalent share of resources without some very tasty carrots and some very big sticks being wielded from above. So if we're stuck with schools, my personal opinion is that we should also be stuck with the Department of Education. Now, Betsy DeVos has been an avid proponent of charter schools and using public money to fund charter schools in Michigan for some years. No mind that Michigan's state constitution expressly forbids the state from using public money to fund private or religious institutions. In 2000, DeVos and her husband tried to get the state's constitution changed so a voucher program for students in school districts with low graduation rates would be legal. They spent nearly $13 million on it, twice what the teachers' union spent to defeat it, 69-31%. In a 2001 meeting called The Gathering, which is an annual conference of some of the country's wealthiest Christians, DeVos and her husband talked about their work in education reform as a biblical battleground where she wants to advance God's kingdom, quote. DeVos and her husband clearly recognize that while they could use their personal billions, he's actually an heir to the Amway fortune, to fund schools, they can have a far greater impact by fighting to change the whole system to, and I quote, impact the view of the community around us with the ideas we believe are more powerful ideas of a better way to live one's life and a more meaningful and more rewarding way to live one's life as a Christian, as Dick DeVos has said. By 2006, the DeVoses were running a couple of different nonprofits, one called the Great Lakes Education Project, which promoted their education policy goals in Michigan, and the other called All Children Matter, which supported pro-voucher candidates in at least 10 states. In the 2010 election, Republicans gained control of the governorship and the legislature in Michigan, and in 2011, the state passed legislation that lifted a cap on the number of charter schools in the state. For-profit companies operate about 80% of charter schools in Michigan, a far higher percentage than in any other state, and the school test results are pretty dismal. With between 24-29% of students proficient in math or reading at grade 4 or grade 8. The state has nearly 220,000 fewer students than it did in 2003, but removing the limits on opening new charter schools has caused for-profit companies to open nearly 100 new charter schools. Some people who back charter schools advocated for policies that would only allow successful charters to open new schools, but ultimately nobody could agree on what success looked like, so they decided not to bother with that criteria. A New York Times article noted that 24 charter schools have opened in Detroit since the cap on the number of schools was lifted in 2011, and 18 charters whose existing schools were at or below the district's already dismal performance expanded or opened new schools. A review of Michigan's 2015 application for federal funding to open more charter schools by a panel of independent experts cited an unreasonably high, quote, representation of Michigan charter schools among the worst 5% of public schools, and that this number had doubled between 2010 and 2014. The amount of money that goes to each school is determined on what are called count days in October and February, and schools buy radio ads and billboards and sponsor pizza parties and carnivals, all to get children in the door on the right days. And all of this while the schools advertise their enrollment periods in newspapers that most local families don't read to make sure that the wrong kind of families don't apply, making the application deadlines much earlier than most families think about the new school year, and requiring lengthy applications, replete with test score results and disciplinary history or special education needs. And they require this of parents who are themselves graduates of an education system that has been failing for generations, many of whom can't read or write at a functional level. The oversupply of schools combined with the recruiting of students leads to students shifting from school to school to escape one problem after another, while never getting the education they need. And what impact does this have on public schools? Well, there are too many schools and not enough students, so the funding just gets spread more thinly than it was before. Public schools lost 46% of their inflation-adjusted revenue over the course of a decade, so the performance of public schools declines the most where charter schools are the most prevalent. Now, if we want to understand how Michigan's case might be applicable to the rest of the country, then we do have to understand how the constraints specific to Michigan have impacted the way the opening of charters affects public schools. As we said earlier, Michigan's student enrollment has been declining, so when more schools open, this very negatively affects schools' abilities to maintain basic services. I could imagine that it's possible, though, for charters to come into a state with overcrowded schools and act as a sort of pressure relief valve. In the mid-2000s, all but 15 states had laws to regulate the maximum number of children in a classroom, but in many cases those rules were relaxed as we went into the last recession and school districts needed to cut costs. We should also acknowledge that Michigan's public schools have been failing to educate children for decades. So it can be really hard to tease out how much of the poor performance of public schools is specifically due to the rise of the charters. It is worrying, though, that the charters seem to be giving parents more choice regarding the number of available schools, but these charters aren't really achieving any better educational outcomes. But really, my aim here is not to debate the merits of charter schools versus public education. Because if you define success as the ability to get large numbers of students to do well in a standardized test, then there are a lot of public schools that do that quite well. At least the ones in school districts that have a lot of rich parents and students who have a goal to get to college and who recognize that if you go to school and you want to go to college, then you'd better do well on those tests. And on the flip side, there are also plenty of schools where children don't do well, particularly where there aren't a lot of rich parents and the system does better at telling children they're stupid than helping them to see and achieve their own potential. And if we look at charter schools, it's perfectly possible to find research that both supports and denies their effectiveness. There are some samples in the references for this episode if you're interested. There's also a relatively new paper that does a meta-analysis of other research, which basically means the authors looked at a bunch of other studies that came to varying conclusions to try and see what were the overall effects. And this found that 6 studies found evidence of positive effects on public schools as a result of opening charter schools. 4 found no effects, and 1 found negative effects. So the overall result seems to be at least in neutral territory, although not in Michigan, as we've seen. A journalist in Michigan neatly summarized the benefits of charter schools. They provide options for families so you're not stuck with just one school. They foster competition, which can make public schools more focused on customer service. They foster innovation, because charter schools aren't constrained by bureaucracy and union rules. And they can carve out a niche to provide certain services, like a Montessori curriculum, for example, and attract families who are interested in that. Some of the cons associated with charter schools include fiscal inefficiency. As one school official said, if you want to improve the road system, does it make more sense to invest in the roads that already exist or build a parallel set of roads? They also create an unfair playing field because while charter schools are technically open to all, as we've seen, they find ways to attract the kinds of students they want and not the kind of students they don't, which also creates a less diverse educational environment. They're usually run by for-profit companies, which have an incentive to generate profit, not to improve student outcomes, so they spend less money on instruction than public schools. They're less transparent than public schools because they're run by private companies, and also because they're run by companies, the local parents end up having very little say in who runs the schools and how they're run. So a well-run charter school can help children in the charter school to get good grades. So, a well-run charter school can help children in the charter to get good grades and may also make local public schools shift their focus and might help students in public schools to achieve better educational outcomes as well. But all of this is a very long way of getting to the point of what if we're asking the wrong question in the first place? What if we shouldn't be asking ourselves what kind of school is the right kind? And instead ask ourselves what kind of environment is best for helping children to achieve their learning goals. So when I started my research for my thesis on what motivates children to learn when there's nobody standing over them telling them what to learn and how to learn it, what I found was that a child must have 2 things. They must be both developmentally ready and motivated. And that's where pre-established curricula get us into trouble. They often force a child to learn things before that child is developmentally ready for no real reason than it's convenient for the teacher and the school. Common Core standards require that children be reading in kindergarten, simply because it's convenient for schools and teachers to provide most information to children in a written format, and if a child can't read, he or she is quickly going to get left behind. But many children aren't developmentally ready until age 6, 7, 8, or maybe even later. Once those children do learn to read, they catch up with the kindergarten readers so fast that by age 11, there's essentially no difference between them at all. I don't know about you, but I found that result pretty surprising. And even once a child is developmentally ready, then you need the motivation part. There are so many stories of children who learn to read in the absence of formal instruction because they got tired of waiting for a parent to have the time to read them the next chapter in a story. They'd sort of been reading for a while and they just decided they wanted to take it on for themselves. I also read about one child who, quote unquote, couldn't read and who wanted to make brownies one day, but neither parent had the time to help. So the child disappeared into the kitchen and reemerged after half an hour to request that the parent find a 9x11 pan and also turn on the oven. Children can and will learn to read if we give them the time and the space that they need. So when we talk about schools not being able to help children achieve their learning goals, we mean pretty much all schools, with the exception of very few schools that don't use curricula. There are a few schools based on the Sudbury Valley model in the US and the Summerhill School in England, where children are allowed to follow their interests rather than follow a set curriculum. What a Sudbury school does, essentially, is to allow children the freedom to learn whatever they want to learn. It's kind of a school as you and I might think of it, in name only. One child at the Sudbury Valley School didn't do much but go fishing the whole time he was there. Towards the end of his quote-unquote high school years, his father started to worry that his son hadn't really learned anything at all. But then the son decided to learn computers and applied himself to that with so much gusto as he'd previously learned about fishing, and then he went on to a very successful career in computer sciences. If the children want to play video games all day in a Sudbury school, they can, and several graduates recall the intensity of their long-term games playing with plasticine. Nobody at the Sudbury Valley School has to take lessons if they don't want to. If a student wants to learn something, he or she finds someone who knows more about it than they do, either a staff member or a peer, and convince that person to teach them about it. One of the school's founders, Daniel Greenberg, wrote about his experience of teaching math, and this is a pretty long section that I'm going to read, but it was so shocking to me that I thought it was worth sharing with you. So the story goes, "Sitting before me were a dozen boys and girls aged 9 to 12. A week early, they'd asked me to teach them arithmetic. They wanted to learn to add, subtract, multiply, divide, and all the rest. 'You don't really want to do this,' I said when they first approached me. 'We do, we're sure we do,' was their answer. I had to yield then, skeptically. I knew that arithmetic took 6 years to teach in regular schools, and I was sure their interest would flag after a few months. But I had no choice. They had pressed hard, and I was cornered. I was in for a surprise. I found a textbook in our library, perfectly suited to the job at hand. It was a math primer written in 1898. Small and thick, it was brimming with thousands of exercises meant to train young minds to perform the basic tasks accurately and swiftly. Class began on time. That was part of the deal. 'You say you're serious?' I'd asked, challenging them. 'Then I expect to see you in the room on time, 11 a.m. sharp, every Tuesday and Thursday. If you're 5 minutes late, no class. If you blow two classes, no more teaching.' 'It's a deal,' they had said, with a glint of pleasure in their eyes. Basic addition took two classes. They learned to add everything, long thin columns, short fat columns, long fat columns. They did dozens of exercises. Subtraction took another two classes. It might have taken one, but borrowing needed some extra explanation. On to multiplication and the tables. Everyone had to memorize the tables. Each person was quizzed again and again in class. Then the rules, then the practice. They were high, all of them, sailing along, mastering all the techniques and algorithms. They could feel the material entering their bones. Hundreds and hundreds of exercises, class quizzes, oral tests pounded the material into their heads. Division, long division, fractions, decimals, percentages, square roots. They came at 11 sharp, stayed half an hour, and left with homework. They came back next time with all the homework done. All of them. In 20 weeks, after 20 contact hours, they had covered it all. 6 years worth. Every one of them knew the material cold. A week after it was all over, I talked to Alan White, who had been an elementary math specialist for years in the public schools and who knew all the latest and best pedagogical methods. I told him the story of my class. He was not surprised. "Why not?" I asked, amazed at his response. I was still reeling from the pace and thoroughness with which my dirty dozen had learned. "Because everyone knows," he answered, "that the subject matter itself isn't that hard. What's hard, virtually impossible, is beating it into the heads of youngsters who hate every step. The only way we have a ghost of a chance is to hammer away at the stuff bit by bit every day for years. Even then, it doesn't work. Most of the sixth graders are mathematical illiterates. Give me a kid who wants to learn the stuff. Well, 20 hours or so makes sense." I guess it does. It's never taken much more than that ever since. So if you want to share that passage with someone, you can have them listen to this episode, or you can direct them to the references at yourparentingmojo.com/divorce. And you can find both the information on the book that it came from, as well as a link to the website where you can read it in full. And I should say that that's one of many examples I could have picked of children learning something because they're both developmentally ready and motivated to learn. Age mixing is also really common at the Sudbury Valley School, where students are free to associate and learn from whoever they please. Peter Gray, a psychologist who's studied this school and from whom we'll get to hear in a podcast episode really soon, notes that this structure, or lack of it, promotes creativity in the older students, who often join the younger ones in creative activities that most teenagers have long since abandoned. When students of different ages play together, they frequently come up with ways to even out the skill discrepancy. The more skilled player tries out novel and risky openings in chess or plays one-on-many basketball. When we free ourselves from the notion that proper learning can only occur when a child is sitting in a classroom following a curriculum and instead learn to recognize it in the many forms in which it occurs in real life, we see that mixed age play and learning helps both the older and the younger student to achieve more mature play and learning than they could in same age peer groups. The problem is, there were nowhere near enough of these kinds of schools to accommodate all of our children. There are around 40 in the US and a smattering in a variety of other countries in Europe and Israel and Japan. So where does this leave us parents who live far away from a Sudbury Valley type of school? Well, it leaves us with homeschooling. So now you understand why I created the course to help parents decide whether homeschooling might be right for their family. So honestly, while I think Betsy DeVos is woefully underqualified for the job of Secretary of Education, the biggest fear I have is not that more charter schools start appearing, is that she provides funding to homeschoolers that they somehow must accept. Because when the federal government provides funding, it's virtually always accompanied by regulation. In some ways, we might see that as a good thing, in the way that federally funded schools are required to produce an individualized education plan, or IEP, for students with special needs. If school districts were no longer required by the government to produce IEPs, then most of them would probably stop doing it. Even now, many school districts refuse to provide special services to children who need them, because it's cheaper to fight those parents who bring lawsuits than it is to provide services to all the children who need them. It's the federal government that attempts to keep all this in check by providing some level of accountability. But my concern would be that because I question the entire premise of a school and of curriculum-based learning as the best way to educate a person, that this funding could be accompanied by regulations that state what I must teach my daughter and how I must teach it. If you'd like to see the 22 references for today's episode, they're at yourparentingmojo.com/DeVos. That's DeVos. And if you'd like to learn more about the course for parents thinking about homeschooling, or if you'd just like to offer an opinion about all this that's different from mine, please do feel free to drop me a line at jen@yourparentingmojo.com. Thanks so much for listening.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Your Parenting Mojo. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, and sign up for our mailing list at yourparentingmojo.com to receive a free gift. 7 relationship-based strategies to support your children's development while making parenting just a little bit easier on you. For more respectful, research-based parenting ideas to help kids thrive, we'll see you next time on Your Parenting Mojo.